You know, my favorite menu in my life is meat. Especially American meat.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Welcome to episode 71 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson. And today, I'm going to be doing something a little bit different. Actually, it's not even just a little bit different. This is a lot different. This is a huge departure from anything that I've done previously. And quite frankly, it scares the hell out of me in terms of doing the research for this show and whatnot. But I figured the timing on it is right. Because you have a show launching on Netflix for its second season tomorrow as this drops, Glow, which you may have heard a thing or two about. Well, I am going to be taking a look at the original Glow, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, the pilot episode that was taped in late 1985. So I really don't have a date. Usually when I start the show, I say, hello, you know, I go through the whole bit and I say, today we'll be looking at WCW Saturday Night from May 25th, 1996. Something like that. But I don't have a date on this. IMDb has it as January 1, 1986. I don't think that's correct. And the show would air in syndication all over the country. And this is because it was sold to like 200 stations at the NATP convention in Las Vegas in early 1986. So I think it was some point after that. So I think it's just going to, for the title, it's just going to say original Glow pilot or something to that effect. So this is going to be a really interesting show. I have no idea how it's going to turn out. I feel like that Johnny Cash, I think it's at San Quentin where he says, yeah, I can't wait to hear a boy named Sue because I have no idea what it's going to sound like. And same thing here. I have no idea how this show is going to go because usually I have a specific format and instead be watching this pilot. There's a lot of music video stuff, and with it being a pilot, it is a bit of a departure from what people would become used to with the Glow show as it would go along. But before I get into all that, let me get my plugs in. You can email the show greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. And you can give me a follow on Twitter. The number is going up very steadily, at GF Allentown Pod. And you are probably listening to this show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon to support Place to Be Nation website with your Amazon purchases. This past weekend, I was down in Atlanta, Georgia, for an Orioles-Braves series just outside of Atlanta, because technically SunTrust Park, SunTrust Field, is not in the city limits of Atlanta. It's out in Cobb County, so I tweeted something out with the big boss man, respect the law and order, because they have all these, basically what you would remember from wrestling shows as the 1980s-style barricades going all down the street to prevent jaywalking, which is pretty important because it's like a four-lane road that you have to try and cross. And speaking of roads, I was looking, like, for things to do in Atlanta, I said, I wonder, is there actually a bad street in Atlanta somewhere? And apparently some wiseacre went on to Google Maps, and you could, if you type in bad street the whole USA, it actually takes you to a place in Atlanta. And I laughed because it turned out to be the state capital of Atlanta. Somebody just managed to label it and sneak it in that way. I didn't do some of the stuff that I was planning on maybe doing. I thought about going up to Scott Steiner's Shoney's in Ackworth, Georgia, and then I remembered, oh yeah, I would have to sit down and eat at Shoney's when there's, you know, other places near that I could walk to that are far better than that. And I don't mean the Applebee's, because when I walked in there Friday night at 1:30 in the morning, the place was a complete mess. They were out of like every single draft beer except for Blue Moon. And when she went to pour that for me, it was like all head. So, you know, you don't want to get head in that situation. So I just said, you know what, I'll have one of the bottles in the thing. And then I just like overtipped and got out of there because it just was a little weird, especially since I had just attended a baseball game, the longest baseball game by innings that I have ever attended, a 15-inning game between the Orioles and the Braves, in which I'm sitting out by the Orioles bullpen, where every single pitcher was used at one point or another, except for Michael Givens, who had pitched two innings the day before. And this game was particularly crazy because the first run of the game is scored on a Chris Davis home run, who had been benched for a week and a half because he's so screwed up. He was batting, I think, 151 or something like that at the time, and he had registered 44 strikeouts since his last home run. So to see that was weird enough. Then the Braves come back. They take a 3-1 lead into the ninth inning, and then out of nowhere, the Orioles score six runs to take a 7-3 lead. And I think, okay, well, this would be nice and easy. You know, it'll be over. So they bring in Zach Britton to close things out in the ninth inning, and he promptly gives up four runs before an out is recorded when Freddie Freeman is thrown out at the plate. And all I could think is, so I saw Zach Britton pitch here, and he gave up as many earned runs before recording an out that he did the entire 2016 season. He gave up four earned runs the entire season. And then the game just kind of went on and on as neither team could generate any sort of offense. And by the end of the 10th, I had to tell my friend, who is a lawyer and really needed to get some work done and also was away from his family and his wife wasn't too thrilled that he was going to baseball games with me on back-to-back days. I said, look, I give you my blessing to go. I know you want to stay or you feel obligated, but you don't have to hang around here and watch the Braves take on a team that at the time was 21-52. But I stayed right up to the very end, and I did not get a baseball from the bullpen like my friend did last year because there was all kids hanging around. It's like, I'm a 39-year-old man. I can't be begging for baseballs. That would just be unbecoming. So I would just kind of do the thing where I would like point and say, all right, that kid is getting the ball. That kid is getting the ball. It's really all I could do in that case. And then I went to the game the next day when sitting in the Delta Club seats, which is all you can drink beer, all you can drink wine. I didn't have any wine, but I drank a lot of beer in the Place to Be Nation chat that I'm a part of. I set the over-under at 7.5, which was pretty much exceeded by the end of the third inning. So I had gotten there probably about an hour and 20 minutes before the game. And when I walked in, I had one of those Spinal Tap moments where they took me on the elevator to the wrong level. So I ended up on like the regular 100 level. And I'm like, I don't think I can get into the club this way. So then after wandering aimlessly, I head down the elevator one more floor, and then you got to walk down this long hallway. And who passes me in the hallway but Manny Machado of the Baltimore Orioles, who I just didn't even say hello to him or anything. I just like nodded, and I was like, wait a minute. Yeah, that was Manny Machado, wasn't it? But I had to go in and have my pizza and whitefish and all that in the club. The Orioles won that game 7-5. On Saturday, and then the Braves got their heat back on Sunday in a 7-3 win. That actually was the hottest day on Sunday, so it would be appropriate for them to get their heat back. It was a heat index of about 95, something like that, that day. I think it was only like 85, but sometimes down in Georgia, it feels hotter than it actually is just because of the humidity. I really do like Atlanta. The term Southern hospitality gets thrown around, and it really kind of exists down there. I like the downtown. I went down there on Saturday. I could have gone to the College Football Hall of Fame, but decided, you know what, I'm actually going to go to the Civil Rights Museum, because apparently I was feeling really woke. And it's kind of a real heavy experience to walk through that and kind of, you know, see the history of civil rights in our country. And also, there's a human rights wing for things around the world, such as, you know, all the other things, dictatorships and stuff like that, wherever you might look, like in North Korea or whatever. So, that was kind of a learning experience there. And then I stayed out way too late on Saturday night going to a place in Buckhead called Industry Standard and having pizza and being entertained by this old guy trying to hit on the female bartender it was her last night or something like that. And then my comical failure to get an Uber or a Lyft for like 45 minutes after I was done there, which is why it took me so long to get home, because it's in like this little neighborhood where the streets are close together, so you can't really get a good location from your phone. I probably should have just walked out to Peachtree or whatever the main road was. And then before you know it, I'm walking into my hotel room at 3:15 in the morning, just completely spent. And then it took me a while to recover the next day. Never again am I going to book a flight out of Atlanta at 6 a.m. as I did on Monday, where I had to wake up at 3:10 to drive to the airport. And then I noticed that my rental car key says diesel, and I don't think they meant Kevin Nash. So I'm like, there's no way that this is a diesel car, that I'm supposed to put diesel fuel in here. There's just no way, because it's a Nissan Versa. I highly doubt that a Nissan Versa has any sort of diesel model whatsoever. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to put regular unleaded in this thing, and if it doesn't start, well, I don't know what to say, because I looked at the manual and I said, no, this has to be regular unleaded. And that was my morning on Monday, trying to race to the airport to get there in time. In Atlanta, it's very important to have the TSA pre-check, because I noticed that it was the largest difference in the size of the lines, and this was at 4:50 in the morning, so I can't even imagine what it's like a couple of hours later. So enough about my trip to Atlanta. GLOW, and it's kind of an interesting thing to sort of talk about, because this isn't the World Wrestling Federation. This is not World Championship Wrestling. This is so kind of out there. And some people might not even consider it real pro wrestling. And I have to say that I disagree with that. And I was trying to put like some sort of value on its importance to at least women's wrestling in history. I think over time, as it gained a cult status, it was very popular at the time and had very strong television ratings vis-a-vis other syndicated wrestling shows, I'm not sure that it had an impact on women's wrestling, let's say like the NXT Women's Revolution or whatever from 2014 through 2016 into what we have now. I think it's more of a, you've taken women's wrestling in the United States, and I've addressed the Fabulous Moolah thing and how she kind of controlled much of the industry in the United States for years and years and kind of had it made out in her own image, where it really wasn't all that entertaining and it also wasn't all that good in the ring from a quote-unquote work rate perspective. So GLOW is important, I think, as a bit of a fresh start, and it's not something that is normal pro wrestling, because I don't think that was the idea that David McLean and Matt Simber set out to do when starting this TV show. McLean is actually a legitimate wrestling fan from Indiana, and he wanted to found a women's promotion out there in association with Dick the Bruiser's WWA, in which Dick the Bruiser said, no, that's not going to work here. And he was probably right. So he goes to the West Coast, he goes to Los Angeles and puts out the audition call. Simber is, he was actually the husband of Pia Zadora at the time, and that would eventually cause him some issues later on in the series run, where he may have fooled around with a couple of the girls, and Pia Zadora was like, I'm going to leave you. So then, you know, he kind of gets cut off from there. He was also married at one time to Jane Mansfield.
You know that Jane Mansfield had some big breasts.
Thank you, Jerry. But there was a certain sex appeal to this show that was undeniable in the documentary that's on Netflix on the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. It talks about how it was there was a certain appeal to the frat house element and for men who would show up to the tapings in Las Vegas at the now torn down Riviera Hotel. But it was not like they just hired a bunch of models. And what I like about it is that they had a diversity of body types and a diversity of different kinds of characters. It wasn't all just the same slim, trim, long-legged model. You had Matilda the Hun. You had Mount Fiji, who was, you know, two of the biggest stars to come out of this, and not exactly the lightest women, but they probably had, I would say, the top rivalry in the course of the promotion's history. And it was at least something different. I always talk about how you don't want wrestling to become too much of a template, which I think WWE falls into now, especially in how their matches are designed at the main event level. It just kind of feels like paint by numbers sometimes. It shouldn't have to be a certain way. Like, you have this crazy thing where it's not bound by any sort of convention. You have the women out there rapping and doing all sorts of videos, which I'll have to call it as I see it, because I was very critical of the AWA for doing the Wrestle Rock rap video, which is around the same time as all this. And as the show was taped at the end of 1985, that is actually when the Chicago Bears Super Bowl Shuffle video comes out. So it was, you know, kind of popular for large groups to get together and just cut a rap, as I was saying. So as for this as a wrestling promotion, I did say that the ratings were good, but there are some elements that it has in common with other wrestling promotions that, you know, we know of that you would think of as, you know, traditional. But there was one thing that they did that was different from other wrestling leagues, to put it in that sense, is they worked seasonal, which is they had 26 episodes over the course of a season. So kind of like a normal sitcom schedule, although that's got cut back more to 22 in more recent years. But back in that time frame, you would see sitcoms do 26 episodes a year. And the idea is that you want to have one run for 6 months, and then the other half of it, you can then rerun those episodes. And there's always been talk in various articles that I've read that don't you wish, you know, WWE or any other organization might go to a seasonal schedule? I guess in other parts of the world where there's like a longer break, perhaps in Japan, that might already take place. But there's no chance in hell, to coin a phrase, that WWE is going to go to a seasonal, considering the amount of money the Fox network is paying them to air their B show. So think about just from the money involved. But I do think it's one of the good ideas of the GLOW promotion. The other thing is most of the cast, which, as I said, this is a pilot, and you know there are some things that we're going to get tinkered with as they go into season one and then into season two. But then after that second season, most of the cast ends up leaving, and they form a new promotion, POW. And it kind of thought, this sounds like All Japan Pro Wrestling and the Exodus in 2000 that formed Pro Wrestling NOAH, or All Japan, the first Exodus in 1990 when you had SWS forming up in Japan. It was mentioned somewhere in my research that David McClain was not really happy with the direction of GLOW at that point because it was becoming a little too much like the show Hee Haw, with a lot of comedic elements and just very sort of slapstick and all that. So he goes and forms his own promotion. But just talking about GLOW, there's elements of stuff from traditional pro wrestling that you see here. It kind of has a lot of the absurdity that you might see in a place like Memphis, combined with a dash of Attitude Era crudeness, which it's kind of funny because you have Tina Ferrari, one of the characters on this, would later go on to be Ivory during the Attitude Era, so she crosses both of those lines. And there is traditional pro wrestling, but again, the quality of the work is not too great. I mean, we're not talking about four-star NXT TakeOver matches with Becky Lynch, Sasha Banks, and all of that. We're still a long, long way. There's still a lot of hair pulling, a lot of snap mares by the hair and all that. There's a lot of, I hate to use the term, but botches. Most famously, you know, Susie Spirit's arm injury, which I believe took place in the second season, where her arm just snapped in half off a mistaken sunset flip where her opponent actually slipped and fell, and because she slipped and fell, she ended up landing on her arm, and then the program actually made light of this injury, just kind of showing the replay on it in super slow motion multiple times. And that kind of goes back to, you know, the absurdity of it. It was undoubtedly campy in many ways. I mean, you know, just the words hee-haw kind of screams that out. And that this is not everybody's cup of tea. And I understand it. And this is a very unusual show for me to be doing. So with all that in mind, enough of my blathering about GLOW. Why don't we just jump in and take a look at this pilot episode? With this being the pilot episode, it's kind of a chance to talk about the Netflix series, where the first season of that show was effectively the build-up to what would be their pilot episode, them sort of getting ready. And it's not entirely true to what happened, nor should it be for entertainment purposes. I mean, there's probably a lot of mundane stuff in the lives of these women, and you probably had to jazz it up, especially since... And this kind of blows one's mind when you think about it. In 1985, a wrestling promotion is started up, and drugs and alcohol are outlawed as part of being in this promotion. So that's just amazing when you think of the wrestling landscape at that time. Here is this all-women's promotion where none of that stuff is going on, or at least impacting everything. But as for the show, I enjoyed it a great deal. Otherwise, I would not be doing this episode in all likelihood. I've always enjoyed the work of Alison Brie, who was on Mad Men as Pete Campbell's a little too chipper wife, Trudy Campbell. Not to say she deserved anything that happened to her on that show, but sometimes she was a little too cheerful, I think, for my taste, that he was, you know, almost going to give me diabetes at times. Betty Gilpin is the kind of breakout star of the first season of GLOW, where she's playing Liberty Bell, which would roughly correspond to Americana in the actual GLOW of the 1980s. And Alison Brie's character is looking for a gimmick the entire time, and she eventually comes up with the Russian gimmick that would come along later in the actual GLOW. Laurelyn Palmer would play Colonel Ninotchka. I'm a little bit less crazy about Marc Maron as Sam Sylvia. Not to say that he wasn't good for the role. It's just that having listened to Marc Maron's podcast, and not particularly regularly, usually just when he has a good guest on, all I'm seeing is Marc Maron. Like, he's not into that character to the point where, like, every time I see him, I'm like, oh, Marc Maron did this, whatever. I have a friend out in California who apparently has set foot in the infamous garage where he does his podcast and says that he is, yes, actually a very peculiar fellow. But also on the show, as a wrestling fan, which is probably why you're listening to this show, because this is nominally a wrestling podcast, at least I think it still is, that wrestler cameos through the course of the season were of great amusement to me. Yes, I knew that Chavo Guerrero played one of the trainers, which made perfect sense because I believe it was his uncle. I cannot remember the exact Guerrero family tree. Mondo Guerrero, who trained these gals back in the 80s. But you also have John Morrison making an appearance at one point or another, and the brother of one of the wrestlers on this is played by Brodus Clay, which I thought was some rather inspired casting. Couple issues that I do have with the show, with it being a period piece, and if you think about it too hard, you realize, oh, well, that wasn't there in 1985. There's a episode where they go to a wrestling show, so I'm assuming that because it was in a very small venue, let's call it an independent show for what that was in 1985, and you see a guy do, I think the move is La Quebrada, off the second or top rope, and I'm like, that was not going on at spot shows in 1985, and it kind of took me out of that episode for whatever reason, but that's okay. I can live with that. I also think the girls on the show might be a little bit better at the actual wrestling part than maybe it actually comes off as on this show, as we're going to get into it with the four matches. But first, there is a music video, the song New Attitude by Patti LaBelle, which was kind of her return to prominence after the band LaBelle broke up in 1977. And there's a period of about 6-7 years before she had her solo album with that song on it that really caught fire. And she was certainly an impact player in the world of popular music through at least the rest of the 80s. These videos kind of serve to introduce the talents and also kind of set up the matches that we're going to have on this show, such as California Doll teaming with Americana to take on Spanish Red and Royal Hawaiian.
If you find something that you love, you've got to do it. I love ice cream. Ice cream is just wonderful. I think every all-American girl should eat a banana split a week.
Well, that's a rather bizarre recommendation and babyface promo. Although, I'm trying to think if ice cream has ever been mentioned on a wrestling show in that manner before. I'd have to probably go through all the Norman the Trucker ones from 89, 90, WCW. It feels like something that might have come out of his wheelhouse. You get Sarah and Mabel, and this is no relation to King Mabel or Viscera or any of that, taking on the duo of Salt and Pepper. And Pepper is better known as Princess Jasmine, who worked in the AWA and in the WWF at various times. And she took a leading role in helping to train the women for this show as well. But her promo here really struck my ear kind of weird.
The food is very great in Africa, and the men's are nice there too. Oh, they got men's all over the world there. They come to Africa. Nice, good-looking, strong men's. Nice and handsome.
Kind of weird timing to be talking about food in Africa, considering there's a famine going on in Ethiopia, in East Africa. It just really struck me as weird. And also, from all of her travels to the places that I had just mentioned, men's? Like, what is she talking about? Men's Teo doesn't exist yet. She's not talking about him. I think that she hung around Pat Patterson or something, is now pluralizing words that aren't supposed to be pluralized.
Hollywood and Vine versus Tina and Ashley.
We're going to kick their asses. They think their sweat doesn't stink. They think they're glamour girls. We think they suck. We think they're sluts.
I love to eat anything I can get my mouth on.
People don't f*** with us. Because if you f*** with us, we'll get our friends on you. Me and Vine, we're tough.
Yeah, I was not expecting to hear an F-bomb either. I was so taken aback by that. I like wrote it in all caps in my notes. The use of the term glamour girls. Kind of funny there, because Judy Martin and Leilani Kai, still a couple years away. And for the de facto feature bout, we have Matilda the Hun taking on Tammy Jones, who's billed from Russell, Kansas, which is also the hometown of Senator Robert Dole, who was, of course, in the United States Senate representing Kansas at that point. Now, Tammy's got a bit of a backstory in that her brother just got his braces removed from his legs, and I thought it might be a Forrest Gump thing, but apparently he was in some sort of car accident, and the thought is, well, we're hoping that he can walk again. But Matilda the Hun, and she really seems to get it from a promo and interview perspective to build to this match.
Tammy Jones, she's a joke. She's a little wimp. She's a doomcuff. You know, my favorite menu in my life is meat. Especially American meat. Fresh, bloody, little, tiny morsels of American flesh.
As the play-by-play man, and he's working solo on this show, David McClain, I do have several issues with his style that I'll get into later. But he actually was not bad in terms of the stand-up to put over Matilda the Hun as a threat.
Her opponent tonight is the 280-pound German Matilda the Hun. Matilda, whom proudly possesses official papers that prove she's a direct descendant of Attila. The experts have called this match a colossal mismatch.
Kind of cool that Matilda has honest to God paperwork linking her to Attila the Hun, since 23andMe did not exist in 1985. So there's probably a lot more legwork to go out and try and prove something like that. It reminded me very much of the Classy Freddie Blassie promo from episode 38, where he claimed that Killer Khan was a direct descendant of Genghis Khan, but he didn't provide any paperwork or anything to that effect. You know, you can just say it on the pilot episode. It's fine. You just gotta get it all out there. So they show the baby faces walking in with poor Tammy, and then the heels led by Matilda are walking in as well. It's kind of like a backstage shouting match, like what you would see now, but then people sort of get in the way, except that it's in a casino ballroom or like out on the floor of a casino, which I thought was kind of funny. And then some hostilities ensue, and security comes by and breaks it up. And I was thinking to myself how security at casinos, they do not mess around. Like, I don't think I would want to get into a fight with like a multi-person brawl, because they will take you into a back room and they will likely waterboard you or something. So just don't, if you're going to get into trouble in Las Vegas, try not to let it happen within the confines of a casino, because who knows what might happen to you in that back room. Then we get another video which features Tina Ferrari. So the future Ivory gets her own video where she's changing behind a door, and then she comes out in her gear and just karate kicks at the camera. And you get a couple of more intros, Spanish Red, Americana, and then they show Jailbait, which is one hell of a name for a performer. And she is out on the street. That is certainly not a gimmick that WWE would ever touch in 100,000 years. I'm not sure which promotion would do something like that. Of course, they'd have to look close enough to 60. Oh, well, you know, that would have been something for the USWA, and I'm not even going to elaborate on why a female wrestler named Jailbait would have been appropriate there. Who knows? There might have actually been somebody, and I just don't know that off the top of my head. And then Salt is dancing on some stairs, which is just kind of nothing to kind of close out the video and take us in to our opening match in Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling History. The team of Spanish Red and Royal Hawaiian taking on California Doll and Americana. And we get these little statements in the circle in the corner of the screen where You know, they'll tee off on their opponent or whatever's on their mind, kind of. Americana feels that an American woman should be a certain way, which left me scratching my head. It's almost rather fascist the way that she talks about that. And Spanish Red, back in the 80s, it was kind of easy to be a pure heel. You could just speak out against apple pie, of all things.
I respect the red, white, and blue, I do. But I just can't stand all this apple pie stuff because I didn't have apple pie, you know, when I was a little girl. I had other things, like buñuelos. Have you ever heard of buñuelos?
I don't want to hear any of that mumbo jumbo. Not America now! You speak English! I want to hear English!
I found it amusing that Americana gets all up in arms because she says, hola chica, as if that's some sort of advanced word or whatever. And like, hello girl, from her native tongue. She seems to be a little bit too sensitive. Snowflake-like, perhaps? No, that's not a term that even existed then. We start out with those two, Americana demanding she speak English. And Red takes her down and puts her in an armbar. And let's just say I was very impressed with Spanish Red over the course of this match. By the way, the ring for Glow, at least on this occasion, I think it lasted for the entire series run up through 1990, is actually a boxing ring. So this is not a normal wrestling ring, which is fine for what it is. I mean, it does make it stand out somewhat. Then she works the left leg, Spanish Red does, with a toe hold, kind of not quite a spinning toe hold, but she is then kicked off. And Red is pretty good at bumping, but it's not totally natural. You can see that she's still in maybe kind of a, you know, I don't want to say beginner phase, but you can kind of feel like they're thinking through the bumps as they're doing them because it seems a little bit mechanical. Yet another inset promo.
They call me fatty, they call me pineapple head, I'm going to show it to them.
I'm assuming that the name calling was coming from Americana while she's also yelling at her tag team partner to speak English because she said one thing in Spanish. Hawaiian and Red are not very good at cutting off the ring. That's something I don't think that it might have been covered in their training. In these matches, you see a lot of very basic stuff like single leg takedowns, double leg takedowns, snap mare. I mean, this is the pilot episode, and these are not seasoned workers for the most part. So you got to keep it basic, and I probably would have kept this a little shorter. On the TV show, they're kind of made out to be a little bit more advanced, as I was saying earlier, but I don't have a problem with that because I'd rather them be a little bit better, you know, for the sake of the show, because I think it gives it a little bit of credibility. California Doll, when she gets her little promo time, she lets us know why, in fact, she became a wrestler.
I became a wrestler because, to me, it's a vicarious thrill of being thrown around, and it's challenging. It's physically very demanding.
Nothing about paychecks in there. But the truth is that this show did help launch the acting careers of a lot of the women who were on here, because they can eventually depart and say that they were on the show and they would still have, you know, kind of a cult following, so they can get work later on. So it did help them in this regard. McLean says that the California Doll works out at the Gold's Gym in Venice Beach, which makes me wonder, did she ever hang out with Hulk Hogan at that time? I don't know if Hogan would have been married in 85. It's just kind of funny to think about. Slingshot by Spanish Red. This is another move that they like doing, but don't think that it's the Kurt Hennig slingshot where it goes up and over and into the ring post. This is a slingshot to just the other side of the ring where you kind of land face first into the mat. It did actually look good in this case. Right after that, Red locks in a front chancery for a while, so if you're going to have a rest hold, it's certainly not the worst one to have. Hawaiian and Americana, they fight on the apron, and California is whipped very awkwardly into the ropes. It was kind of like she hit the ropes like a divas wrestler from 2009. I want to say like Kelly Kelly, who would hit the ropes weird. I can't remember that whole time period is just a blur, and gets taken down for a two count. And as I said, Spanish Red looks a little bit more advanced than some of the others in this match, but she runs into a boot in the corner. Now we get an original production technique where it is slowed down. It's live action, but it's moved into slow motion like it was an instant replay, where Hawaiian runs in, but California Doll escapes over the top. It almost thought she was going to do like a sunset flip type maneuver, but it was her just kind of getting out of there. Tag gets made to Americana, and she runs into trouble right away. Royal Hawaiian gets her in an airplane spin. But before she starts spinning around, she brings her over to the other side of the ring, where Spanish Red from the apron gives her a smack on the butt, which I thought was kind of funny. And the airplane spin gets a two count. And then they drag her, Americana, over to the corner where they're going to crotch her on the ring post. They're not going to do the Bret Hart ring post figure four or anything like that. They're just trying to crotch her on the ring post in the corner. The baby faces each get hip tossed. And at this point, I'm wondering, when is this match going to end? Because this is going on way, way too long.
She just better be ready, okay? Because I'm just going to smear her on that mat. We're talking Hawaiian crush.
When the going gets tough.
That Hawaiian crush has nothing to do with Bryan Adams as Kona Crush. This is a splash off the top rope to get the win after 15 of the longest minutes of my life. This took me back to watching that Sabu Sandman match from November to Remember 97, where it went on for 21 minutes, and if it had been 15 minutes shorter, it would have been great. I'm not going to say that this match should have been 15 minutes shorter, because then it wouldn't exist, but you have to get the promotion off the ground somehow. I just wish it had been a little bit better than this. Maybe a little bit more Spanish Red in the ring, and maybe slice about 8 minutes off this and use the remaining time to promote some of the talent.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which of course includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Before the next bout, which is Sarah and Mabel taking on Salt and Pepper, which, by the way, it did not occur to me that it is like Salt and Pepper, and so maybe they could have had Spinderella as their valet. I don't know. But a valet would have been helpful for them, because we get a little character building with those two condiments or whatever. They're fighting over clothes, and this just takes me back to my childhood with my two older sisters fighting over clothes. And I don't think one of them ever broke a bottle over the head of the other one, which was a little bit startling, I have to say.
Give me my dress!
I don't want to give you a dress! I take it to the cleaners!
I'll clean it myself. Nobody told you the word. You should have asked me first.
I don't need anything from you.
I don't. You'll never get anything from me.
I know. I don't need it. I don't need your help. I've never needed your.
You gotta pay it. For this. Do you understand?
I am not.
You gotta pay for
this.
This is some of the best storytelling on the show, where you've established this team, but they already have tensions in the pilot episode. But we've got to unite them somehow, and there's no better way to do that than to have the other team come out with these white masks on. I didn't quite understand what that was all about. And I thought that the F-bomb earlier would be the most controversial thing said on this show, but I was wrong.
I never borrow a hanky from a honky.
hey, there are different ways to be a heel. You can put down apple pie, or you can just use racial slurs towards your opponents. I mean, either way, but they had chains. So we get a heel beatdown right here. And it made me wonder, is Bill Watts booking this territory right now? Because this was an ultra-strong heel beatdown. I was reminded, listening to the latest episode of Wrestling Warzone, of how when he was in the WWF booking during that very brief period, there was a heel beatdown of Shawn Michaels, Diesel, and somebody else. It might have been Bam Bam. I can't remember. From a Raw in October of 1995. And this is kind of the same thing before Pepper finally recovers and clears the ring. But no, Bill Watts is booking Mid-South in late 85. And boy, I'd love to get my hands on a copy of the episode where Ric Flair meets Ted DiBiase, because that was one hell of an angle. It turned Ted DiBiase into the top babyface at UWF, where he pretty much remained until he left in 87. The rules for countout here are a little different. It is not the 10 count that you might be used to. Instead, it is a 20 count, which reminds me that it was a 20 count in the game Pro Wrestling for the original Nintendo. Now, I know that there have been video game podcasts on the Place to Be Nation pop feed lately. I don't think any of them are ever going to bring up pro wrestling for the 8-bit Nintendo system, because when I would go in and I would play, and I would usually play as King Slender, even though he had the longer road to get to the world title, which I think was some sort of nod to Lex Luger, because King Slender looked an awful lot like him as sort of the blonde muscle man. In order to save time, I would try to get out of the ring and do a pile driver on the floor. Speaking of that DiBiase ankle, do a pile driver on the floor and just win that way, because it's a lot more efficient to do that. But this one is not going to end in a countout, as they are outside the ring and Sarah picks up a chair and breaks it over Pepper. So this is the most ECW glow match in its two-match history to this point right now. And if you think getting hit with a chair was an ECW spot, what happens next, and I can't play the play-by-play on this because it doesn't do it justice, because I don't think David McClain would know what to call it, but Mabel gets AA'd onto a table and through a table. So, two matches in on Glow, you can say whatever you want, how it's campy, how it's cheesy, and yes, it is all those things. They're doing ECW-style table spots in 1985. Not too many of those going on. I mean, Randy Savage had pile-driven Ricky Morton through a table not too long before this, probably within a year, year and a half of this. But other than that, now you're seeing people getting, by the way, an AA, too. I mean, who's doing a Death Valley Driver back then? I mean, it was the closest thing to an established move that I could actually call it. And this match is really fun. It's actually telling a story, and I'm enjoying it, maybe because it is hewing to traditional pro wrestling mores. But once again, after the match, you know, they these two, they're like Salt and Pepper, they're like sisters. They're still arguing about clothes.
Well, we had a big problem between us, but you know, we really don't need to fight. We've been friends.
What was the problem?
It's about my clothes. She wears my clothes all the time.
I don't mean to. I don't have enough clothes. But you know what? I love her. She's my best friend.
And with you, such a
they realized that they had more in common than their disagreement over clothes. That takes us into our next bout, which is the team of Tina Ferrari and Ashley taking on Hollywood and Vine, accompanied by Aunt Kitty, their manager. And Hollywood is actually the first woman who was hired for the Glow project. And as it turns out, Hollywood and Vine did not get along in real life. It is a cool name for a tag team, Hollywood and Vine, because it is a famous intersection in North Hollywood out in Los Angeles. It's kind of like the St. Louis Blues or the Baltimore Orioles. It's a name that flows and makes perfect sense. And as I said, these two did not get along, and eventually Vine would leave. And while this is different from professional wrestling as we know it in so many different ways, what led to their breakup is quintessential pro wrestling in that they roomed together for the 2 seasons that they were a tag team on GLOW, and they just became tired of each other's personalities and clashed on all sorts of like little stupid issues, like the first to enter the ring and first to enter the arena. And Vine never wrestled again after leaving GLOW. So just kind of interesting. Very similar to many tag teams you've heard of over the years. I mean, the Young Stallions are one of the ones that come to mind. When Roma and Jim Powers, they get a little bit of a push, but they don't get along. Marty Jannetty and Shawn Michaels, they got tired of each other around the time that the team was going to break up. A little bit more on Ivory, or Tina Ferrari, as she's known at that time, getting into the WWE Hall of Fame, inducted by Molly Holly this year. And I have to say that if it wasn't for the GLOW show on Netflix, I don't think she gets in this particular year. I think it was kind of one thing piggybacking off the other. I mean, by the standards of the WWE Hall of Fame, and you're going to have a female inductee each year, she certainly, I think, was deserving, at least from that perspective. But it's funny to see the contrast in her, because when you think of Ivory in the Attitude Era, the first character that comes to mind is when she's in Right to Censor as the white shirt wearing prude who speaks out against all the vulgarity during the Attitude Era, which I have to admit, she had a good point, I think, at the time. So kind of a detested character. She was also the manager for D'Lo Brown and Mark Henry, which is how she got the name Ivory in the first place, coming in early 1999, sometime around the Royal Rumble, I want to say. And she did win the Women's Championship on more than one occasion. But you think of her in that role in Right to Censor, and, you know, very, very prudish. And here, she's literally on a team that is called TNA, because it's Tina and Ashley. And what are they doing? They're flirting with the crowd openly, like giving guys kisses on the cheek and stuff like that. Another honor that she won, and I don't know if this had something to do with something that went on in GLOW Season 2, but she won Wrestler of the Week on Pro Wrestling This Week, the Joe Pedicino show that also, I think, had Gordon Solie on it from time to time. She was the winner of the Wrestler of the Week from the week March 13th to the 19th, 1988, which would have coincided with the second season of GLOW, as I understand it. And one thing I should point out, this is, as I mentioned, in Las Vegas at the Riviera in a ballroom. So similar to the AWA around this time in filming in Las Vegas. However, unlike the AWA, this promotion, which literally just started, knows enough to actually make sure that the seats in the front row are filled in and not leaving 7 empty front row seats for every match like the AWA was doing in that show I did a few weeks back. Start out Hollywood working over Tina Ferrari early, and then cheap shots Ashley, who was not paying attention on the apron. You got to keep your head up, and I don't mean in that Tupac way. They cut off the ring better than the earlier teams, Hollywood and Vine, do. They get the eye rake on the rope, trying to disfigure Tina Ferrari. And I'm thinking, Jesus, they got some strong heels on this program. Maybe Bill Watts was booking this and just didn't want to tell anybody just because out of embarrassment. In my researching GLOW, and I've been watching a lot of different GLOW videos, I get this recommended thing of like, why Jim Cornette hates GLOW? And it says, still, like, all right, I get it. It's not Jim Cornette's way, so he's not going to like it. I prefer to keep an open mind as to, you know, there are different kinds of wrestling that can work. And I know he doesn't, you know, believe that it only has to be one way. But, I mean, pro wrestling can take on many different forms. And, you know, you don't have to watch it if you don't like it. I mean, a lot of people You don't get to be a cult following without, you know, having people behind you and enjoying your program, even if it is for ulterior reasons. I mean, oh my God, when I get to YouTube comment theater, I'm going to have to censor some of the stuff that was said in that as people recalled what they were doing to themselves when they were watching this in the 80s when it originally aired. Tina does eventually make the tag out to Ashley, but another slingshot to nowhere happens. I don't know why that move is bothering me. I guess it's, you know, just something simple. I'm just so used to somebody going into a turnbuckle and doing the move that way that seeing it done in a different fashion is just kind of weird. Miscommunication spot by the heels as Vine gets whipped. It was actually a reversal of an Irish whip into Hollywood's knee. They were trying to do the Arn and Tully, you know, give me a knee or whatever on the apron, but it backfires on them. And then Tina shows that she knows a wrestling hold or two and locks in a short arm scissors. So this is two Greetings from Allentown episodes in a row with a short arm scissors, as we had Bob Backlund last week showing off his chops. I had mentioned earlier David McLean on commentary, and for the most part, he's relatively inoffensive because he's passionate about what he's calling. And I don't know about you, but for me, if the broadcaster is passionate about the product, I like to call it the Brent Musburger thing, where you watch Brent Musburger for years and he would have the same passion for calling the Little League World Series as he would if he's calling the NFC Championship game. It was all kind of the same. He would bring that energy through. And McLean does that for much of this. I don't know how much wrestling he had called in his past. As I had mentioned, you know, WWA, I don't know if he had done any broadcasting out there. But at least he's passionate about it. However, it is leading into some bad habits that maybe it's just the way I'm hearing it, but he kept repeating a phrase, and it was making him sound like Jameson from the WWF, and that really bothered me.
Again by the ankle. I'm telling you, these two girls are cheating. Holly and Vine have seized every opportunity to cheat. Right now, jamming the forehead of Tina right into the mat. Holly is cheating again. She's cheating again.
That's four versions of the word cheat in 13 seconds. So needless to say, I hope for Christmas in 1985, somebody gave David McLean a thesaurus so he could use alternative terminology for that. He had to have at least gotten a little bit better after the first episode. But luckily for us, Aunt Kitty makes her way over to the commentary table and then just starts wailing on him, which is kind of funny. That did shut him up for a little while and I guess calmed him down. As Tina Ferrari is sent face first into the mat, they return to that slow-mo thing to really kind of drive the point home. Now, the crowd is actually very much into this. They show, you know, crowd shots of people in the front row, and it's not like it's a robotic sort of thing like you would see with WCW Worldwide. These were like middle-aged dudes who looked like they were really invested in seeing Tina Ferrari and Ashley win this match for whatever reason. It's also a different time in 1985. There might be people who, you know, still believed. As I had mentioned earlier, the Russian woman who's Colonel Nenotchka, she had a relationship that was actually harmed by her being the Russian character in GLOW, where she was with this guy and he was very turned on by her character, but when he found out that her as a person was not that character, she got dumped by him, which is in the GLOW documentary that is on Netflix. And before I forget to mention that, that documentary did win an award, I believe it was at the San Diego Comic-Con in either 2012 or 2013. The thing I'll say for it is the first 15 or 20 minutes of that documentary is a little slow. It takes a while getting in. And then after that first 20 minutes, it gets really good. And then the reunion scene at the end where they all see each other. In some cases, they hadn't even seen each other since the show was canceled some 20, 25 years before. So kind of an emotional scene. Ashley gets back in there. She has some control, but then tags out to Tina, who, I really popped for this because I thought she was going to do a cross arm breaker. And I thought, if I see that move in 1985 wrestling on an all women show after seeing somebody get AA'd through a table, which I legitimately could not believe actually happened. Tide eventually shifts back, and Vine then hits Hollywood again in another miscommunication spot off the top. Then the two are whipped into each other in the center of the ring, you know, the corner-to-corner move. And now it is time for the rowboat.
It's rowboat time! Row those oars, baby! And they're doing it like they're doing it to music. One, two, one, two! And his legs are being stretched of Holly and Vine, and they're feeling the agony and the pain right now. They're being set up, if you will. Tina taking a moment, a pause for the cause, if you will, to pinch the referee.
I can't recall the last time I saw a match with a rowboat spot that did not involve midgets. So that's a staple of the midget comedy match of the 70s and 80s. I mean, it's pretty much in every single one of them. And I have the kayfabe hat on for this because they did a hue to kayfabe in this promotion. The heels had to stay with heels. They had to be in character all the time, even in public. And these women, they look flexible enough that it's not going to... you know, it's not going to hurt them too much where, you know, you do the thing with the legs. And I think it might be doing more for the guys watching it at home because as the character Sam Sylvia says on Glow on Netflix, it's like pornography you can watch with your family. And that is kind of the motivation for some of the people. As I mentioned in YouTube comment theater, it's going to be littered with all that sort of stuff. So I don't think that this move works the same way it does with the midgets. It's just kind of stuff to do. They go back to the well with hip tosses, which another common move that you're seeing here. It's definitely something that they worked on. It's simple enough to do in the training. And then an airplane spin by Tina. Vine is in the move. Hollywood tries to make the save by coming off the top and kind of makes contact with both of them. It looked like it was very awkward. And then we get an even more awkward pinning sequence, which they kept doing this, where they would go down for a pin, and instead of it being a clean two count, person would roll the shoulder, and then the referee would have to start over again instead of the normal kick out that you'd see in the course of a match. It's something that takes some getting used to, but this one was done so ham-handedly to the point where the three count actually occurs when the camera has cut away to something else going on. So this seemed very WCW the way that this went down. So it did not end up as well as the last match despite the presence of a future WWE Hall of Famer.
Police Munitions, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PoliceMination.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. The PoliceMination Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and HistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I eat it plain, from the tortoise to the tummy, from the rump to the brain. I eat raw meat, I eat it raw. You better give me your beef as I bust you in the jaw. Raw meat, raw meat. I need your meat to feed.
When it comes to campy rap tunes, that one by Matilda the Hun isn't that bad. I mean, she's no Nick Bockwinkel by any means or any stretch of the imagination, but you know, that is a pretty good one where she expresses her fondness for red meat or for 1999 Sean Stasiak. It's really hard to tell which one. I'm glad Stasiak got out of the business before he got drafted to SmackDown, because those same jokes really, really just do not work if he had been on that show, because there's no rhyme set up. So I particularly like Matilda the Hun because, as I said, she really seems to get this wrestling concept. And then we cut quickly to Tammy Jones, who is, yes, a small underdog sympathetic figure, but holy crap, does she have an annoying voice.
I'm a little wrestler, short and strong. Here is my bicep on my arm. When I get all steamed up for a bout, I just grab him and knock him out.
There's more than just a little bit of Fran Drescher in Tammy Jones's character in terms of her voice, and that's nothing against Fran Drescher. Over time, I've learned to love the show The Nanny as one of the most unappreciated sitcoms of the 90s. Like, if you're a guy, you sit down like, why would I watch The Nanny? It actually is very, very good if you sit down and you give that show a chance. I'm just saying, you know, you kind of have to go deep into your cable channels before you'd find it. I think it's on, I want to say it's on Logo from time to time, so it's not a high def channel, or at least I've never seen that offered in high definition or whatever. So I'm supposed to cheer for her just because she's a little underdog. Am I supposed to be prejudiced against Matilda the Hun just because she likes to eat raw meat and because she's a bigger lady? I don't think so.
Flesh, or I'll start to scream, I'll foam at the mouth and act like a fiend.
And I don't think I'm completely out of line, because when they cut back to the audience after the song, they are in the middle of a chant of raw meat.
Raw meat, raw meat, raw meat, raw meat.
You can hear them, fans. Raw meat, meat they're raw yelling. Meat. That's the theme song of Matilda the Hun, and this is the match that's been called the Colossal Mismatch. Poor Tammy Jones, who's in a state of depression, as you can see. She's going over to her corner now and praying.
Started to realize watching this show that David McClain sounds more and more like the late era WCW Scott Hudson, when he was just so beleaguered calling WCW Saturday Night in like 1999 and 2000. Yes, Tammy, the bell rings, and then she turns her back to go pray. I mean, pray on your own damn time, okay? You're in there against this monster who immediately takes advantage of her praying for her brother. I mean, do it on your own time. It's a kind of a dangerous situation, and she wastes no time, Matilda does, throwing her outside, body slam on the floor. So, like I keep saying, she gets it. She knows how to be the monster of this show. Then we get a slow motion splash. So once again, the slow motion effect is being used. And this is shaping up to be a total squash, but Instead, Matilda pulls her up at the two count. And you know what that means. When the heel pulls up the plucky underdog babyface, who is not a pure jobber at a two count, that kind of kind of tells you what might happen. She's just kind of screwing with her, mussing up her hair. And Tammy ends up outside again. And in something out of No Holds Barred, she looks over and she sees her brother Johnny, who is on the crutches. And this is all very similar to Rip at the end of No Holds Barred, seeing his wimpy brother Randy, who had gotten beat up in that giant warehouse hangar by Zeus, which, by the way, Randy did throw the first punch there, so he did kind of bring it on himself, but it kind of reminded me of that whole scene.
Johnny, you made it! You're all right!
It's her little brother, Johnny! He's giving her the signal to go get him, sister!
I'm gonna get her!
As you would expect, Tammy starts to make her comeback with something of a spear, but Matilda does not go down because she's twice as big as Tammy. We get a slow-mo on the second try where she does a little bit more damage, and it's starting to look like that Simpsons where Homer gets hit with the cannonball at the Lollapalooza Festival, and then another one, a third one for more, but then Tammy eventually gets caught, and she has her up, and then she is biting now. So the raw meat, it doesn't just mean red meat. She will eat white meat if it's available. Tammy Jones.
The other white meat. Taste what's next.
It's probably a good idea to not go around acting like a white meat baby face if your opponent has expressed fondness for raw meat through song. I'm just saying it. Tammy does fight back with a sleeper hopping on Matilda's back, and she's still all inspired by her brother out there on the crutches. And then eventually she scores with a flying body press off the top rope. That gets her the three count, and Tammy Jones is your, in very improbable fashion as I'm watching this, first GLOW champion. And I couldn't believe it, even though I kind of forgot to actually think, oh yeah, this is probably a match for the first title, and I could have just looked up the title history. So I found myself shocked that they didn't have the monster go over here, and then you have all the other girls fight back against her. But you want to tell a story, you want to make it a feel-good story for your pilot. It probably tests better for audiences going forward. After a little bit of celebration, there's a brawl in the ring, and there are a lot of different women in there. It looks like it's the whole roster, so now I'm thinking that GLOW has accidentally provided the template for the go-home show for every Royal Rumble that the WWE has run in the last 10 years, where the whole roster hits the ring, and then they fight in there like, oh, look, everybody, it's going to be like this, the Royal Rumble, even though no, there's never any more than like 7 or 8 people in the ring at a Royal Rumble, at least in my memory, because then it becomes too chaotic and too much like a regular Battle Royal. So, hey. And then McClane, once again, taking abuse, but this time from Matilda, who justifiably wants a rematch. You know, I do think she is entitled to a rematch after losing it. It is a match that I do want to see again, not because I hate Tammy, and yeah, I do have some sympathy for her and the whole story with her brother and all that cockamamie nonsense, but Matilda, I want to see more of her. And she would be one of the biggest stars through GLOW up till it ended in 1990, and certainly one of the more memorable characters. If I gave out show awards, I think she would probably be the MVP and likely the best worker, although I did have quite a fondness for the way Spanish Red worked in one of the earlier matches. And as McClane is getting hassled, that is pretty much how they wrap up for Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, the original pilot, which was taped December 5th, 1985 at the Riviera Hotel in Las Vegas. As I've been producing this show, I've come to find out that the original GLOW pilot episode aired on September 13th, 1986, and seeing the title change history, it does say that Tammy would have won the title on tape delay on that date. I mention that because Take My Breath Away by Berlin was the number one song in the United States on that weekend. And also because you get a 9-month span between the pilot and the first airing of the show, which isn't all that unusual if you watch various TV shows. I mean, go back to the Brady Bunch. Like, some of those kids are tiny compared to what they are even in the first season. It can really happen when you have a kid-centric show like that. You probably want to have a little bit less time. Anyway, for my podcast roundup of shows that I know are well past the pilot episode stage, on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, this week they examine the conspiracy behind Nick Patrick's three count at Starrcade 97. The only thing I really take issue with what they said was calling Nick Patrick a good official, because my theory is if he was a good official, they wouldn't have made him the corrupt one in the first place and did that whole character. I think he was a good official maybe in around 1990, 91, and 92, when he was kind of a logical successor to Tommy Young. And I'm not exactly sure what happened, because even before his little NWO stint, he was starting to become a noticeable bad referee. You know who's not a bad referee is Mike Crockett, even though he's on hiatus hosting the wrestling podcast About Nothing with Ring of Honor's Brian Malonis. And this week, in light of the sad passing of Vader, one of the greatest big men in the history of professional wrestling, they have a chat about their favorite big men in wrestling over the years. And on the Place to Be podcast, I believe it comes out today. I think they have a later show this week on their schedule. They'll be looking at the April 1988 MSG show, which you might think, oh, just a, you know, house show or whatever, but there is a Demolition versus Strikeforce match and Ted DiBiase taking on the Macho Man Randy Savage for the World Heavyweight title. But in looking at the results, there's one thing that it eventually aired on Primetime Wrestling on May 2nd, 1988, so it's on the network. I'm not going to play spoiler, but let's just say there's a Barry Horowitz, Jose Luis Rivera match, and it has a clean finish. So one of those guys is going over clean. And I love these MSG all-jobber matches, because you just never know what's going to happen. And speaking of unpredictable, it is now time for what is undoubtedly going to be the longest version of YouTube comment theater that we've ever had on Greetings from Allentown. As always, these are actual YouTube comments made by users, whether they've watched a little bit of the video, a lot of the video, or if they just want to be really open about what they did to themselves from watching GLOW, because holy God, there were a lot of people who felt the need to tell us how they fapped to GLOW. Like, really? Do you have to share that information even though it's relatively anonymous? So let's just go into this. Jam Dev says, I'm only 8 minutes in, but someone please tell me, did Little Johnny ever walk again? I'm going to tell you that Little Johnny did in fact walk again, and that little boy grew up to be John Cena. And now you know the rest of the story. Retro Morrow says, never thought I'd ever watch something like this. Netflix owns my soul. And yeah, a lot of attention, of course, from that TV show, and it's the whole reason why I'm doing this episode this week with the second season. I mean, it seems pretty obvious. Stephen Hill says, this is unapologetically 80s. And yeah, if you want to get a little bit of a time capsule to women in the 1980s and styles and fashions, you could do worse than by watching a little bit of this. Serge the Blurge says, OMG, I cannot believe how good this is. Fun and hysterical all at once. Seriously, this stuff is better than men's wrestling. We seriously need a female federation to come back again. I'm sure that there are some out there. I'm thinking Shimmer, for example. Of course, it's completely different from what GLOW is, focusing more on traditional wrestling than what GLOW was. Eric Otani says, in today's social setting, Spanish Red would be the face and Americana would be the heel. And there seem to be a lot of sentiments going through the 700-plus comments on this video. So I'm doing God's work here, kind of weeding this down into however many I'm going to read, probably about a dozen. Louisiana Rivas says, this is so ridiculous, but I can't stop watching. LOL. And yeah, I think that was part of the appeal back in the day and why so many people watched and enjoyed GLOW. Corey Moore says, I had a crush on Vine as a kid. Okay. Douglas James says, When I was young, I jerked off to these matches like crazy. Hollywood was number one target. Now, why does Douglas James feel the need to go on to YouTube? Luckily, it's got the avatar, just the letter D, and not his picture. Like, why would you need to go on there and share this information with the world? I don't know. Death Star Diva Disney says, Glow, home of the pancake booty, LOL. I remember watching this as a little girl. Man, the memories. Ha ha. Now, I had to look up what pancake booty is and what that... According to the Urban Dictionary, it is a woman who looks like she has a large posterior from behind. However, if you look at her from the side, it doesn't stick out very far. So, say, there's not much junk in the trunk, I think is the phrase that's used. Bad Boys Rewind says, LOL, I'm pretty sure California Dolls Cooch is hanging out at 2350. Yeah, there was a lot of timestamps of when people thought that they were seeing things that they probably weren't seeing, and a lot of comments about certain hygienic things down in that area. Oh boy. KMBKB says, I love it. Can't believe I thought this was real when I was little. Danielle Rush says, this was good TV. Roderick King says, this really made me laugh. All matches have been sanctioned by the Women's Wrestling, Women's National Wrestling Alliance. The Danteezy says, Trump probably loved this. SMH, scratch my head. I want to say that there's some sort of Trump glow video out there, and I don't really want to walk down that road too far. John Cooley says, me binge-watching the Netflix series. There's no way this show was actually this ridiculous. Original pilot. Hold my beer. Stan McSare says, and the Riviera never recovered. Well, there are other factors of why the Riviera ended up closing years and years later, 30 years later. Its location on the North Strip, I think, is less than ideal. You want to be center or south strip because that felt like that was where more of the action was. On the north strip, on Las Vegas Boulevard, some of those casinos up that way seemed a little dated. Stuff like Frontier, Circus, and all that. I remember when my friend Bob stayed at Circus. He was concerned that it was going to smell like elephant dung in there, and he actually asked me if it was okay from that perspective. And finally, RRW Missouri says, and this is a personal anecdote about Matilda the Hun. I first met Dee, Matilda the Hun, and her husband Ken in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles at a party in 1971. Was friends since that time, although moving out of California kept our communications very limited. Dee did a lot more than just glow in her life. Just go to Yahoo and place in the search engine her real name, Dee Booher. You'll find all kinds of information about her. Not all, though. She was a dear friend that I miss. Her health conditions today are not good at all. Peace and love, Rick. I'm fascinated by the fact that she's playing a monster heel and her last name is Booher. The heel's name is Booher. Oh, that's just fantastic. That'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Now for next week's show, I'm going to keep it very classic and also something different from what I've done previously, because I've never covered this particular show, although I've gone to this territory several times in the past. I'll be looking at Mid-Atlantic Television, and this one will be from November of 1981. It depends what date and where you look. In some places it says November 14th. In some places, like the WWE Network, it says November 21st. So it's just safe to say Mid-Atlantic Television in November of 1981. And this show is a
veritable
all-star team of mid-80s WWF guys. Thank you very much, Chad Campbell. There's Roddy Piper. There's Sergeant Slaughter, who's the U.S. champion coming off his successful run in WWF earlier in 81 and extending back to 1980. You have Jake the Snake Roberts and Ricky Steamboat teaming up with each other in 1981. It's kind of an odd pairing to see, who will remember their blood feud from 1986. Angelo Mosca makes an appearance via videotape in kind of hilarious fashion, which I will get into. And promoter Sandy Scott wants to attract some, you know, talent to the territory, some big names, and he's got an idea to potentially get those guys in, maybe some sort of incentive. So all that and much more next week on Greetings from Allentown. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music, and spread the word about this show. If you enjoy it, tell a friend, tell 2 friends who will tell 3 friends. You know the whole deal. And tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
I'm 100% woman, but I wrestle like an animal. And I belong in there because I'm an animal. What do you think?